This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Now, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to be nation. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Sharon Lawson Bram, let's get him a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Let's get a rinky do.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I've wanted to drive that freaking hoe train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pot. What's a mouthy scrapper, Katie?
That's a bit much. You, who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious.
5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts, and we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richards. That gets you caught up in the octa or dead for moving. It's just like that as we proceed. Saturday night special, better take it light. You jive, jive, you're a capitan. Quest to the coast, the key logo, wire the chain gang. Keep your ears out for Roy Ayers, sip the fountain blue. House of bamboo, paradise. This is it, what? Luchini pouring from the sky, let's get rich, what? The GT box is sugar dime, can't quit, what?
Please stay on Nacion! Welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rosero, coming at you on this Monday evening. And it's a very cool episode. We have a really special guest coming up later on talking about his brand new book, of course, and that is James Dixon, talking about the Titan series that he's written in the newest edition about 1997. So we'll talk all about that in just a few minutes. But before that, normally I'm joined by my PIC, Scott Criscola. He is elsewhere tonight. He is, of course, working the big Sword and Shield Golf Classic for his Knights of Columbus troop. So he's out there running the ship. And actually, the golf tournament's probably about over by now. They're probably partying. So he's in no shape to join me tonight. So for the first time, I think, in like 409 episodes, I'm going to be almost flying solo. But before we bring in James, I did want to bring in my PlaceToBeNation.com friend and compadre and good time all around pal. And that is Steve Willey. Steve, how you doing?
I am doing well. This is episode 409 on the mothership. Got 91 to go towards the big 500. It's going to come up sooner than we think.
Only 3 years away, probably, but that was great. I enjoyed that a lot. I hope Scott does as well.
How was your weekend?
It was good. Thank you. Thank you for asking, Steve. It was a great time. I'm already looking forward to August when we get to hang out in person.
Indeed. I'm going to go deep in the basement. We're going to watch some sexy Steve.
Yes. Look at you. You're really prepared for this, huh? Catching them all flustered. So you are here for a specific reason besides just to fillet me, and that is to talk about a brand new show that's going to be launching here at PlaceToBeNation.com, and that is coming about 10 days from now. The 22nd is the launch date. We felt there's a little bit of a void, and there's so much great modern wrestling out there today, whether it's a WWE, you know, where there's some stuff, NXT, but also around the world, you know, Ring of Honor, New Japan, Lucha Underground, so much stuff to cover these days, so much to talk about. And we have Main Event, that can't cover it all. We have Mission Indie Possible, that touches on it, can't cover it all. So we thought there was a gap for another show covering current day wrestling. And Steve, you and I are going to be part of that. And would you like to unveil the name of that show?
The name is called Clotheslines and Headlines, or CNH for short, not to be confused with the White Sugar brand.
So Clotheslines and Headlines, the podcast brand, will be coming at you every other week starting on the 22nd. And Steve, we're not flying solo, so it's going to be a three-man booth. It's going to be me, it's going to be you, And it's going to be the godfather, Nate Milton. So Nate will be joining us every other week. You may know him, of course, from shows here. You may know him from Live Audio Wrestling, where he does, you know, Review and Impact. And he's, you know, calls in every Sunday and talks to the guys over there, John and Way and Jason Agnew and Levansky. So, you know, he's very popular in those circles. And he's been a great friend to us, has the King of Sport podcast. He's been here at The Place to Be. So he'll be co-hosting along with myself and you, the Rayman Booth. And we're also going to have lots of guests on. So these will be guests that come in to talk on each topic. So we're talking New Japan, we'll bring in a guest. We're going to talk Ring of Honor, we're going to bring in a guest. And we're going to, you know, preview pay-per-views, we're going to break down pay-per-views, we're going to talk news of the day. Very excited for this. It's already broadened my horizon, stuff I've had to start branching out to. I know you're a big fan of the indie scene and a big supporter of Ring of Honor, so looking forward to giving you the forum to talk about that more as well.
Yeah, that's what it's going to do. Like, you know, with Scott, he, on the main event, they do more WWE-type stuff, and he's kind of been branching out to other stuff as well. So we are not throwing Scott out to the wolves. We are doing this with his blessing. And, yeah, we will be doing, you know, Nate's a longtime follower of Impact, and we all have been supportive of Ring of Honor and watching Lucha Underground. So I think it will be kind of fun to, instead of doing, like, some of the deep dives that other people do, is just kind of, like, shoot around the horn. And it kind of reminds me, like, the headline shows you used to do.
Right.
Back in the beginning of the podcast, where we'll shoot around the horn, and also reminds me of like the old sports reporter shows where everyone's kind of sitting around all grizzled newspaper guys with their cigars and cognac and blue curacao. I don't know. I was just thinking of random liquors that I could come up with.
Malibu.
Yeah, Appletinis.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're aiming for. It's just, you know, we're going to keep it crisp too. You know, we and I failed to mention, we do have another show as well this week in wrestling, but that's really niche. That's like this week in wrestling. You know what I mean? Whereas we're going to go more holistically, looking at the couple weeks in between shows. But they go for a while and they go really super in depth. Like we've talked about, our goal is to really, you know, cover a lot of stuff in under 2 hours, bring you what's going on, our picks of the week, you know, things to look for, things to watch for, our predictions on main cards, reactions to news. Just a really a quick, almost like a SportsCenter when SportsCenter was good kind of show.
Oh, I like that. That's like a good comparison.
That'll be our tagline. SportsCenter was SportsCenter.
Like SportsCenter for wrestling when back when SportsCenter was good.
Perfect. You can't beat that. So I'm really looking forward to it. You know, I wanted to have you on here to announce it because it's such a big deal. So if you have any ideas or suggestions for the show, let us know. Reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter. But definitely look forward to it. It'll be on the Place to Be podcast feed, of course. And like I said, it'll be every 2 weeks. You know, and things are going to settle back down to with our normal schedule. Kevin Kelly's show will be returning in July. Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast should hopefully be back in July as well. So things should start settling down too. So we'll go ahead, Steve. Let's go ahead. Why don't we take a break? You're going to leave because you got business to take care of, and I got business to take care of. So I'm going to be talking to James Dixon about his books about 1995, one of my favorite years to talk about. So, anything else before we take a break?
No, not at all. I'm going to go do another podcast right now because I am a man of the world. I'm a man on the mic, and well, I'm actually barely a man. But yeah, I'm looking forward to our new venture and looking forward to listen to the interview.
Because
promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tourneaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Scott Keith, the former Net Cop. You're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
All right, we are back from break and very excited because here tonight, like I mentioned in the open, have on with us, or I should say, is James Dixon, author of the Titan. I've been calling it the Titan Sinking series, I guess. Is that where you're going with the name, James?
That's kind of what it turned into. I mean, right. It wasn't originally supposed to be a series at all, to be honest. It just evolved into that. But yeah, I mean, I call it the Titan Sinking series, and I think most people do, or just the Titan series.
Awesome. Well, the Titan series author is here with us, James Dixon, all the way from overseas in England. And thank you for staying up late. I know you got NXT ahead of you, but appreciate you taking some time out to talk to myself. Of course, Scott Criscolo, my usual partner here on the show, had an event tonight, so I'm flying solo, but it's great to have you on. So what we're going to do is we'll talk a little bit about the books. We'll talk about 95, 96, and 97, too. Why not? I got you here.
I know him well.
So let's talk about the books themselves. You have two editions that were out already in this series, Titan Sinking and Titan Shatter. That was 95 and 96 into early 97. And then the latest version coming out now covers 97 up until about WrestleMania 14, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we decided to sort of change up the timelines a little bit because the end of the year isn't always the end of the season, as it were, you know, or the end of the story. It tends to be WrestleMania.
Right.
That's when they sort of reset and go again. And we figured, you know, the end of the 97 story wasn't really Montreal. It was what came afterwards, you know, in the couple of months after that with Steve Austin and Mr. McMahon. And, you know, we thought WrestleMania 40 really, I think people generally consider it to be the birth of the Attitude Era. For all the Titan books really are all about the birth of the Attitude Era. That's the overall running theme of them, is how it came about. And it's, but really that one pivotal moment, that one show, it was Tyson, it was Austin, and it was Mania 14. So we figured we end there, and then we'll go from there in the future. Should we inevitably go into the future?
I think you will. You seem like the kind of guy, once you get
rolling, it's gonna happen.
You're not going to sit back. Now, you say we, and our good buddy Justin Henry, I think, is involved in this latest book. Now, was he involved in the others as well? Did he help you out?
He wrote me the foreword for the second one and for Titan Shattered, and he sort of read over it before anybody else. And he actually got in touch with me after reading the first one, Titan Sinking, and was like, look, man, I'd love to work in a project. And I'm like, well, I've nearly done Shattered, but the prospect of the 97 book, as yet unnamed 97 book at the time, it was just filling me with so much dread because I knew covering Montreal was going to be a nightmare, you know?
Right.
I mean, everybody's covered Montreal, and there's so many different sort of inaccurate versions of it out there. One of the things I'm like, sort of the most proud of with these books is that I've delved into the history and found out, you know, the real story. Like, for example, in Titan Sinking, the story that Shawn Michaels was beaten up by 12 Marines, you know, in Syracuse.
Right, right.
And it's like, no, that's WWE's version of what happened and Shawn's version of what happened. And nearly in every occasion, their version is different to reality, and as you, I'm sure you know, and I'm sure all your listeners know as well. So it was things like that you find out the truth behind it, and sometimes it's not always like, I know there was controversy in the first one, Randy Savage and Stephanie thing, but that was, you know, it wasn't presented as that was what happened. It was, this is the evidence to suggest why it could have been that.
Right.
And with Montreal, there was a lot of that, like somebody's opinion differed completely to somebody else's opinion. I think there was a whole... if you ever looked on the Wikipedia page, not that you should for information, but you know, if you ever did on the Montreal Screwjob, it comes up with a list of discrepancies and like common misconceptions, that kind of thing. And we were at the start, we were like, you know, we've got to sort of make sure that every one of these is answered and is correct in the book. And it might not be new information for some people, but the way it's presented hopefully tells the full story and from every perspective as well. So it's not a WWE-centric version. It's not a Bret Hart-centric or a Shawn Michaels version. It's a lot of them sort of bundled together and sense made out of them, you know, so you can see everyone's side.
Yeah, that's a big part of the books because, I mean, you know, deep down, a lot of this stuff, like you said, is, you know, we got to take all the evidence that points one way or the other, figure everything out and what makes the most sense and what can be corroborated and maybe not, but at least we have enough circumstantial evidence to point us in that direction. And that's what makes the book so interesting that it's like, yeah, this is guys who did their homework, put this stuff together, took the most trusted sources we have on the subject, and here it is for you in a narrative form, which is even better. Sure. You know, it's not a message board post. It's not Meltzer tweeting stuff. You know, you're trying to piece together.
Right.
It's a story. You know, we were joking off air. I, you know, I was telling you how I came about the books, but also how I enjoyed them was I came across them from our good friend Scott Keith. Over at the blog of Doom, plugging them, and I think you had even posted there a little bit, and that's kind of how.
Yeah, he's been a real help in getting the word out there for them.
And he, yeah, so I found them there, and I did the 30-day trial on Kindle solely to read them at first, and then at the gym on the treadmill on my iPhone was how I read them.
It's fascinating to me.
A lot of long.
How can you read them with all the words bouncing around like that?
You know, you just kind of get used to it, I guess. You balance out, but it kept me going because I wanted to keep reading. And you know, I do like an hour here and there. I'm like, oh man, I just want to finish this chapter. You know, so you keep pushing yourself.
And I find that fascinating. I do like finding out because that's one of the sort of the worst things about writing a book is once it's out there, you know, you get a few comments on maybe Amazon or whatever. A couple of people might get in touch, but you don't really. Know how people enjoy it, so you or if they do at all. So it's, you know, you don't really get that interaction with people of, you know, oh yeah, I read it like on a plane, or I read it when I was doing this, or you know, I was in hospital, or whatever it might be, and you don't get to find out a great deal. So it's always really fascinating to me when I hear like, oh yeah, man, I read it at the gym. I was like, yeah, great.
Yeah, I didn't weird never ones expect- that you've come across.
Yeah, I mean. Maybe not weird, but interesting. I mean, I don't know if you guys over in America know a guy called Chris Travis who used to wrestle in the UK.
Yes.
Died recently.
Yes.
But he was a friend of mine because before I was a writer, I used to be a wrestler over here.
Okay.
It's which helps really to understand the business, I think. And when he was ill, because he had cancer, he had stomach cancer, and when he was really ill in hospital, he read the first two books and they really sort of helped him. And I thought, you know what, that makes it worth it alone.
Right.
That you could have helped a guy who's going through that and sort of taken his mind off this horrible disease. And so I'll always be really proud and pleased, you know, about the books because of that one fact alone. So anything else, if there's anything else like that out there, and I really hope there is, then great. I mean, that's fantastic to hear for me.
Yeah, it was a very sad story, Chris Travis. We have listeners and readers in England that, you know, kind of alerted us to a situation and we followed along with it. Sad. Very sad.
Yeah, so. Horrible.
All right. So I wanted to kind of start at the beginning of this. When you started kind of piecing together the idea for the books, what put you in this direction? What made you decide to tell the story of not only the Attitude Era, but like you said, kind of the birth, the groundwork, and I guess the burning down, like you say, sinking, shattered, and now, you know, we're starting to rebuild. But what led you in this direction, and what kind of made you decide to put it in this format?
Okay, so it was a couple of things. The first thing was I bought my very first Kayfabe Commentaries DVD a couple of years before I wrote the first book, and I thought the format was so good, the timeline series that they do, where it's like, you know, pick a wrestler, pick a year, and discuss everything that happened in that year with them. And I thought, you know what, that really works as a format for a book. Why not do a sort of a history of wrestling and document the real history of wrestling? Because there isn't really anything that does that out there. And, you know, do it like almost like an annual year by year. And it was sort of intended to be month by month, and it didn't really work that way because once I started to get into writing Titan Sinking, it became a case of, well, there's actually a narrative here of,
right,
Vince is struggling, and then, you know, he's struggling or has struggled because of the steroid trial and the sex scandal and you know, Hogan leaving and all that kind of stuff. And then just as he's about to rebuild, he's got this click to deal with. And then, bam, WCW comes along with Nitro and we start all over again. You know, Vince up against the wall. And I think Vince is at his most interesting when he's backed into a corner. And, you know, he does different things. He doesn't do that now because he's not in a corner anymore. But at the time, it was every week he'd try something different, try something new. Mm-hmm. And it was a really fascinating tale. And as I was writing it, I realized that really the birth of Attitude came in 1995. That's when the first seeds were sown as far as changing direction. There was a lot of subtle sort of hints there that that's the way they were going. Think Blood started to reappear and, you know, matches were a little bit more violent, like Kevin Nash and Bret Hart Survivor Series was, you know, basically a hardcore match, an early hardcore match. And some of the sort of characters they were doing were a little bit more edgy, like Diesel being sort of a tweener after that match. And so it was starting to go in that direction. And then when that book was sort of nearly finished, I realized that was the narrative. So I thought, well, I'll try and tie this all together into this. And at that point, I realized, well, actually, it doesn't really end in 95 at all. It ends way in the future, a couple of years down the line, with the real birth of Attitude. So then it became a trilogy. So that was what happened. But it was inspired by kayfabe commentaries originally and then just sort of evolved from there. And I find any time I write a book like this, it always changes from what it's intended to be in the first place. But I think that's a good thing.
95 is such an interesting year, too, because it's one that, you know, if you visit any blog or message board or discussion forum, they're always like, oh, 95 sucked, worst year in history of wrestling. And when you look at it on TV, you know, week-to-week TV, oh, yeah, probably right.
Maybe.
But there's so much interesting stuff that was happening and that you cover in the book going on behind the scenes that you're like, all this turmoil. And like you said, every week trying something new, mixing things up, switching the format of Raw, giving the belt, you know, which is amazing that he stuck with Diesel on top the whole time when he's changing almost everything else about the promotion behind the scenes.
Well, he was the tallest guy in the room, so.
Right. He stuck with him. But yeah, so, such a fascinating year, and I was so happy that that's the year you picked because, and this is, you know, the topic I wanted to get into with you is kind of your fandom when you started watching and kind of how deep you were as a fan at this point because I was super into WWF and WCW in 1995. I was 14 years old. I was kind of right in my wheelhouse. I started watching in 90. And 95 was like, I was all in. So to have a book that dove into all that stuff when it's really a year that would get ignored a lot in a lot of historical documents and as we got through the Attitude Era, that's what really spoke to me. So what was your fandom at the time in 95? Were you watching avidly or is this something you had to go back and learn a lot about?
No, I mean, I've been watching avidly and have never stopped since 1990, the same as you, actually. So, you know, it's been constant for the last, getting on for 30 years. So, and I remember it like it was yesterday because I was much more invested then than I am now. I still watch it now, but it's different when you're a kid, you know, and you want to absorb every piece of information. And, you know, I loved that time, even though it was terrible, it was a simpler time and it was an interesting time. As we said, Vince was trying new things and for all behind the scenes, I didn't have a clue what was going on back then. You know, looking back on it now is fascinating, I think. And as far as why I picked that year, though, I mean, it was just, like you say, it's never really been documented. And I was sort of looking through, I was like, I could do sort of 84, 85 and like the birth of WrestleMania. But it's been done before a couple of times and could do sort of the Attitude Era in general, but that's kind of been covered a little bit as well. I was like, you know what, this era hasn't been covered, and there's a lot of interesting stories dotted throughout, you know, be it the Click's sort of rise or, you know, how Bret Hart and The Undertaker were getting pushed to the sidelines a little bit and the general change in ethos and bouncing back from the various lawsuits and people leaving, WCW coming along, and there's just so much going on that I was like, well, you know, that seems like a good starting point. And I'd love to say that I planned it all out and went, you know what, we'll start in 95, there's a logical end in 98, and it's this trilogy, and it's going to be the birth of the Attitude Era. But it wasn't when I planned it. It was just, this is an interesting year. This is one book about 95. That's it. And it just became something more. So, thankfully, I'm glad it did. But, yeah, I mean, at the time, it was just, yeah, there's nothing else about it. So why not?
And I was really glad you went into 96 for the second book because, to me, you know, many look at, and me included, look at 97 as arguably maybe the best year in you know, modern wrestling history. When you look at the whole timeline, and, you know, WWE was starting to pick up steam. WCW was really on a roll. ECW was maybe at their peak.
Then,
you know, that's not even counting Japan and, you know, Lucha and all that. But 96 to me is the year that really set it all up. And you can see, you know, we talk about the week-to-week changes from Vince. That's the year, too, where what you started to see at the end of 95, some of that attitude changing, the characters becoming a little bit more real, which is funny because everyone always jokes about T.L. Hopper and Sal Sincere. But those guys were brought in for a very specific purpose, and it was a very smart purpose, right? They brought these guys in as names to give wins on superstars or on house shows and put over the younger talent. But it's
It was a Carnette idea, you know. It was sort of they looked at the roster and realized they didn't have enough to sustain Raw as it was by, because they were trying to go against Nitro with its marquee matches every week, and they'd never done that before. It was always job guys, and they were like, "Well, you know, our roster's too thin to be beating everybody every week." And they'd always protected their guys so well before that, and they were like, "Well, Carnette goes, well, you know, we could bring a bunch of veteran guys from the circuit in, make them gimmicks, make them underneath gimmicks, so they've got, you know, a little bit of character and name value when we eventually beat them, but give them a few wins first." He certainly didn't say, "Let's make them into a plumber, let's make them into a, you know, a stereotype hick or whatever else." And so that was just, you know, Vince got his hands on it and it became a disaster, but that it was done with the best intentions, yeah.
And it's funny because you see they all come in like within like 2 weeks. You know, it's like in
the summer. Immediately just this influx, yeah.
It's all of a sudden all over superstars. But, you know, 96 too is where he started to really gut the roster, flush out a lot of the guys, the Deadwood that had been hanging around, and really start to bring in, you know, a lot of guys that WCW had just kind of let go when they did their refresh, you know, a couple years before. So they started bringing in Austin and Mark Mero and Vader and Goldust and all these guys that had been turfed, but they had a lot of mileage left on the tank. And, you know, I know Jim Ross, I believe, was a big part of that as well as Cornette. But
massive,
You know, I mean, so you want to talk a little bit about that whole movement?
Yeah, it was like a talent swap almost. It was strange because you had all these WCW guys who were really good, young talent, you know, not all young, but some of them, like Austin, fairly young at the time. And, you know, it was like WCW had nothing to do with these guys for some reason and couldn't figure out how to use them. So Vince gets his hands on them and also couldn't figure out how to use them at first, but eventually cracked it. And whereas WCW became the old boys club, and it was strange, but because it was these two sort of different audiences almost, you know, you had this sort of southern audience with WCW and the eastern, you know, audience with WWF to a degree. I mean, I know they were both international and national and such, but as far as like where they were promoting, it was new faces for them, you know, because Hogan in WCW, for example, people hated him for so long when he was supposed to be a face because he was from New York. And it was such an interesting time in that sense, because you had these two sort of reboots at the same time. And I mean, it's 20 years now from then. And, you know, we've got anniversaries coming up of like Austin 316 and the NWO's formation, you know, the Pillman and Austin angle, and all this kind of really huge stuff as far as how influential they all were ultimately down the line. I mean, maybe not at the time. Certainly in Austin 316's case, it wasn't that overnight sensation that WWE claim it was. You know, the next month he worked with Mark Mero on the undercard. The month after he was on the pre-show. He wasn't even on the next two cards. Yeah,
just grossly done at that point.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, that's a push right there, you know. But they sort of didn't know what they had, I guess. And Vince was, it was this whole, this new type of babyface, this anti-hero, and he had no idea what to do with that, because he was used to say your prayers and, you know, take your vitamins, Hulk Hogan, all-American good guy babyface, and Steve Austin was obviously absolutely not that. And Vince, you know, struggles to change with the times, and that much is evident as much now as it was back then, and it's other people around him or things becoming so popular that he can't ignore them. Like Daniel Bryan in more modern times, that's what forces his hand eventually. So but on the other side, you had Bischoff, and he was, you know, stealing some ideas from Japan. He'd spending a lot of money to bring in these guys, and, you know, for all you know, people maybe discredit him because, you know, he just spent all this money. But yeah, he did. But at the same time, he did have a really good creative direction for them. Mm-hmm. You know, he may have borrowed it liberally, but he still knew where to go. And he really got behind it. Whereas when the WWF tended to do things like that, they'd sort of half-ass it a little bit. And you only need to look at it. Yeah, or not see it through. You know, like the Alliance in 2001. It's like, if they went full bore with it, that probably would have worked. But that's a story for another book, I guess.
That'll be number 6, probably. Number 7, something like that.
Oh, God, I don't even want to think about it.
All right, so you mentioned the process before, kind of, when we were discussing Montreal. But really, if you don't mind taking a minute to dive into it, kind of where you find the information, gathering all the detailed information, and then not only just finding it all, presenting it in such an easily digestible way. Do you want to take a moment to just kind of talk about the process that you follow?
Sure. I mean, one of the biggest influences as far as the style was Shauna Sayles' Sex, Lies, and Headlocks book.
Yes, yep.
I read that cover a bunch of times, and it is factually inaccurate in a lot of places. It is, and as much as I love it. But it's also, I think, stylistically very well done. And there's very few other books out there that have wrestling books, rather, that have that same sort of narrative structure and that same sort of style as telling the story rather than just describing what happened and looking a little bit deeper into the reasons behind it. And I thought, you know, that's sort of a good starting point to go from and then, you know, establish our own style with it when we write it. And as far as getting all the information, it was a combination of everything. I mean, there's so much out there now. You know, everybody's got a podcast, for example. You can't always trust them. So and everyone's done a shoot interview, everyone's done radio interviews, or whatever it might be. So it was a case of sort of getting all that stuff together, getting all the different versions of the story, and then talking to people I know in the industry who were either there or have heard stories themselves, who I trust as well. You know, that's important. Like, for example, Dave Meltz has been a really great help. You know, if I ever need something checking, I'll just hit him up and he usually knows immediately. Jim Cornette obviously was there throughout this whole process and on the booking committee and privy to a lot of, you know, the goings on behind the scenes. So he was really useful as well for things like that. And there was a lot of guys though. I mean, there's more than just those who were there and could tell me, yeah, look, this is what happened. This is what I saw. And then you sort of match that with the podcasts and the shoots and everything else and figure out, okay, this guy's lying. And this is probably why he's lying, so we'll discredit that and then figure out the actual story and use a bit of common sense as well. You know, it's and being in the industry before, sort of I know or have met some of the players involved and sort of can see how they work and see how the industry inside works as well. So it gives you a sort of a different perspective, I think, than most writers would have on it. And it's... Once you sort of take the pieces away that are obviously nonsense, you do get a clear picture of what actually happened. And I think, I mean, I'm quite proud of the way we've done that with a couple of things, like stories that have always been out there that there's always misconceptions about and always various versions about, like the Vader-Paul Orndorff fight, for example.
Yes.
Or for example, like Vader again with Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam. What was the plan, you know? They say, well, I'll find out, you know, and let's find that out and do some research. And sometimes it takes, for one piece, it'll take days and days of research of, you know, listen to everything you can find. I mean, I've got probably a couple of thousand DVDs with shoots and everything on them, everything out there. So it's painstaking, but I also have a bit of I wouldn't call it a photographic memory, but it's sort of borderline as far as wrestling knowledge, like retaining wrestling knowledge. So I have a good idea of where to go for stuff, right, or what issue of what magazine this interview might have been in. And so that makes it a little bit quicker, but you know, it's still, yeah, late nights and long days and, you know, painstakingly looking for this one quote from this one guy. And then the worst thing about it is I'll always forget to like reference it at the time.
Right,
so it'll come at the end, which is hellacious. It's always the worst part of the whole process because I'll go back and then at the very end, I'll be like, oh man, I got to do the references. So I got to go through every single page and You'd think after three books I'd have learned.
Right, right. You'll start marketing them as you go.
Hey, but I haven't. So.
Have you had anyone reach out to you yet to contradict once the books have been published? Like to say, you know, this isn't true, I saw you put this in here, or have you pretty much all been positive?
No. I mean, not from anyone in the industry. I had a couple of, sort of fans go, well, that's not the real story. And I tend to find that the fans who say things like that, it's usually, well, that's not what I heard.
Right.
I know. Well, that's the whole point of this, you know. It's right. Just because you don't know it to be true doesn't mean it's not true. And wrestling fans can be really funny about things like this. I mean, it depends on their age partly and sort of how long they've been following and how long they've been following behind the scenes. But sometimes fans have this conception of this is what happened because I saw it on this WWE DVD. It's like, well, great.
Last place to trust, yeah.
Yeah, it's not always. Sometimes they can be more truthful than people realize, but you've got to sort of be able to read between the lines of the BS and the truth of them and what sort of people's motivations are when they're telling the story or who's pointing the camera at them. All of those things do matter. And, you know, it's – but as far as wrestlers, no. I mean, I always send a copy to Jim. I always send a copy to Tom Pritchard. I always send a copy to – a couple of guys who I also talk to, and they always, you know, come back with, you know, that's the most accurate version of events I think I've ever read or seen about it. So, which is good enough for me because they were there. So,
and yeah, those are the best guys for you to trust too. I mean, we've had Dr. Tom on our shows a couple of times, and a guy that really at this point in his career has zero axe to grind. You know, I mean, he was there for a lot of stuff. He's got a ton of contacts. He's heard a lot of stories, and he has no. He's still a huge fan of the business. He talks well of the company, but not so much that you think he wants a job. You know, he's like, he's one of those guys that's just, you could put a lot of credence into what he says because he just doesn't have that axe to grind or he's not looking for a job. He's just kind of in that sweet spot of seen a lot, heard a lot, knows a lot. He's happy with his life.
Absolutely. I mean, he's been, people don't realize maybe how long he's actually been there, but I mean, he started in 93 with WWF. And he was there the whole time, up until, you know, fairly recently when NXT sort of changed and took over from FCW. But yeah, he was there the whole time behind the scenes and working with the talent and, you know, grooming the next couple of generations worth of wrestlers. So he's seen everything. And if he doesn't know, he knows someone who does know. So I know one of the criticisms that these books sometimes get is how could you possibly know that this person was feeling this or this person said that. And people are like, well, you've took sort of creative artistic license with it. And I can understand that, but that's not really the case because I will ask somebody who knows those people who will either ask them or will tell me what they saw. And so it's not guesswork like people think. The fact that it comes across that way is almost a good thing because it's like, it's obviously something they weren't aware of before or something they hadn't seen or heard before anyway. So I don't mind that being the case. But that just to clarify that, no, I'm not just guessing.
Well, now you can, and we'll believe everything.
Yeah, right.
You've laid the groundwork. So going through these first three books, what's the most surprising story or information or kind of tidbit that you've learned of throughout this time? Something that really caught you off guard that you hadn't heard of before or you weren't aware of that really kind of surprised you, were excited to put it in the book?
I'll give you one for each book.
Okay, cool.
I think 95, the Type Sinking book. I think the Sean and Syracuse revelation was a pretty big one for us to have in there because everyone knew it was BS that it was, you know, a dozen Marines, but nobody knew what actually happened. And what I actually did, and the story of how I found this out was ridiculous, but I was looking online for a little bit more information about the club where it happened. I think it was Club 37 or something like that. I can't remember now because once I write the book, it's gone. You know, it's out of my head. Yeah, so move on. There's only finite room in there. But yeah, this club in Syracuse, I was just looking for a bit of information about it, if it was still open, so maybe contact them, see if they had any records of the bouncer who might have been on the door that night or anything like that. And I came across this fantasy baseball forum, strangely enough. And it was just like, oh, does anyone remember Club? I'm going to say 37. Apologies if that's not what it was.
Yeah.
Does anyone remember Club 37? And there was this post that sort of caught my eye. But this guy said, no, I represented the guy who did this, this, this. And I was like, it's worth having a look at least. And when I clicked on his profile to see if I could find more information or anything on him, there was nothing there. There was just this one picture of this, I think it was like a dog in a hat or something, some baseball hat. So I Google image searched this picture, and it brought up this guy's website, and it turned out he was a lawyer. So it sort of, I thought, well, there's a chance that he maybe did represent this guy, and he is really a lawyer. So I contacted him, and it was the lawyer who'd represented the one guy who'd beat up Sean.
Right.
And, you know, I talked to him on the phone for a while, and he said, look, you know, I'll send you, and I'll tell you whatever you want to know. You know, statute of limitations passed, so it's fine. And he sent me the written affidavits that Sean and Davey Boy and the witness or the guy who was being accused had all written and were used in court, so which no one's ever seen in wrestling. So it was a really big thing to have this in there. And there's a couple of excerpts in there from those affidavits as well. And I thought that was really huge to have, because it was, you know, this accurate portrayal of this incident that nobody had ever really heard the full story of before. And then in 96, I thought the stuff with the click was really interesting, how with the curtain call, how Vince had not only approved it, but, you know, it was so strange. Like, Vince changed his mind only because of all of his staff kicking off in such a manner that he had no choice, and he was in this really strange position where, you know, he had his back against the wall, but in his own company, and he was almost risking his own position, you know, his position of power, because he'd accepted this and let this happen. And he wasn't bothered that they were breaking kayfabe in Madison Square Garden, but Gerald Briscoe was, and Jim Ross was, and Jim Cornette was, and, you know, all the older wrestlers were. And so he was like, well, hell, you know, I got to do something about it. Otherwise, I'm going to look weak. So even though he told them, yeah, go ahead, he then had to punish Triple H. And I thought that was really interesting to sort of get to the bottom of that, because it's been said before that Vince knew. But to really explore it and delve deep into the mindset of why Vince changed his mind and why it became such a thing. Because on the night, it wasn't really a thing. No one really cared as far as, like, to the click. No one said anything to them. It was only afterwards when it became this big talking point, and it wasn't a big deal till it became a big deal, as I think Sean puts it, which probably sums it up, one of the most truthful things he says in the entire series.
And the most clarity, anyway.
Well, yeah, it's maybe one thing he can remember. But he gets, I just want to say about Sean, he gets buried in these books. He really does.
Oh, yeah.
But for the record, I'm a huge Shawn Michaels fan. Huge Shawn Michaels fan. I think he's probably the greatest wrestler of modern times, if not all time, in the ring over such a long period. But he was, as he will be the first to admit, an utter dick in this time period. So he does get a roasting, but I think a justified one. But I do like the guy. So.
Well, he even says it in that, when they did that kind of sit-down interview with him and Brett on the DVD. And you can tell Brett, you know, Brett's memory, and he has all the stuff logged, and he's just ripping mm-hmm. through the stuff. And Sean's like, oh, if you say so, yeah, I was an asshole. And, like, Brett's just unloading, right, like, thing after thing that, you know, you did this, and you did that, and you did this. And, okay, yeah, probably I was a prick. Yep, I was drugged up. Yep.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Sean was drugged up, and that was the biggest problem. And he had the weight of the world on his shoulders, because finally he was the guy. He wanted to be the guy for years, and finally he was the guy. And then immediately his friends leave him, you know, his rival disappears, so he has to carry it on his own. He doesn't have sort of Brett to carry the load underneath, even though he'd never admit he'd want that, but he did. And, you know, it was this, his friends go to the other side and become successful, and his friends are the ones who are beating him every week. And WWF failing makes him look like the failure. And that combined with the loneliness and everyone hating him in the locker room, and, you know, just, and the addictions, you know, I can understand why he was the way he was based on that. It's not an excuse, but I can understand why he sort of fell into that dangerous mindset. But yeah, Sean's a very interesting character study over the course of this. And the 97 book does end you know, it basically ends as Sean's career, or that first chapter of his career ends as well. You know, it's become the whole sort of first three books have been about, almost been about him and Vince, with Brett as well. And like Sean, you know, in 95, he wants to be the top guy and he's trying to control the locker room. And in 96, he gets that. And then in 97, he wins against his great rival as far as behind the scenes playing the game, because Brett gets screwed and he's the one who's picked to stay. And then within a couple of months, he's out, he's done. Vince has moved on, WWF's moved on, and he's just a broken shell of a man. And you know, all of a sudden the business has passed him by, when literally 4 or 5 months earlier, he was on top of it. You know, it's just such a...
in the world, probably, you know? That yeah,
it's a fascinating story, really. But as far as the 97 one, just to finish the earlier question, the most fascinating revelation in that came from my good friend Jim Cornette, who didn't... I wouldn't like to say he went as far as taking the blame for the idea of the screw job, but he certainly admits that he planted the seed, the first seed. So it was offhand he did come up with that idea.
Wow, that is interesting. That is definitely something I didn't realize he was involved in there. So
it was, I mean, I don't want to bury him because he's a good friend, but basically what happened was him and Vince and Vince Russo, they were all at Vince's pool, and they'd been going over and over this finish. How do we keep Brett happy? How do we keep Sean happy? How do we get the belt off Brett before Bischoff's announcement on Nitro the night after Survivor Series? How do we make the company not look weak and the belt not look weak? And every single scenario, he won't lose in Canada to Sean. Well, can he lose somewhere else? He doesn't want to lose before the pay-per-view because he thinks it ruins the pay-per-view. Sean won't put him over because he's leaving, etc. Never-ending stream of nonsense. And at the end, Cornette was just, God damn it, Vince, just screw him, just take the belt off him, it's your fucking belt, you know. And Vince was like, huh, well, what do you mean, pal? And Cornette was like, well, you know, just if you want it off him, just double cross him, you know, just don't think it'll be like, because Vince had done it before with Wendy Richter, he's like,
right,
you know, don't think it'll be like Wendy Mueller, because if Sean tries to cinch up on him or put him in a small package and Brett realizes and kicks out, he's going to beat the piss out of him. Right there on TV, he's going to kill him. So, you know, and that's all Cornette said. But he didn't, and he did say this, said, I didn't think in my wildest dreams that would be what Vince then did. Because double crosses weren't a thing anymore. They weren't part of the lexicon anymore. It was, yeah, there was the thing with Wendy, but before that, there was something for like the 20s and 30s back in the Carney days. And it wasn't something that happened, not in the WWF, not on global TV. And he didn't think that had happened. But then later that night, Vince was talking to Hunter and Sean, because they'd always ring him on a Wednesday for a conference call. Basically the click checking up on what's going on and throwing their 2 cents in. But Vince had listened to them because he loved listening to people who stirred the pot, and he loved listening to those guys because they had similar mindsets that he does. And Hunter said basically the same thing. And to Vince, that was like, well, I've got these two guys in Hunter and Cornette who are almost diametrically opposed in their views on wrestling. And they've both come up with the same idea on the same day. Maybe there's something to that. And then they started talking about it, and when it became apparent that Sean would go along with it, then that became, okay, maybe that's what we'll do. And so it all develops from there. So it's a lot of the Montreal story people are going to know already, but there's little tiny bits and pieces that just bring it all together, and, you know, that I think are the most factually accurate versions of what transpires.
Such a fascinating time. I mean, that's why this 97 book's going to be so awesome to read, because, I mean, just all the stuff that happens building to Montreal and how fascinating Montreal is, but there's so much that goes on leading up to it. I mean, if every week in 97, it was such an awesome time to be a fan, because you could feel that momentum coming at the end of 96, and wrestling was so dead and so dormant, and all of a sudden it's creeping, and you're like, oh, man, I'm so happy I was on board. It's like your sports team when they suck for so long, and you can feel it, right. You can feel them starting to get better all of a sudden, and it's like, man, this is making it worth it. And as lifelong fans of the WWF, when you see them start to get this momentum, and every week the product's just a little bit better and a little bit better, and all of a sudden, you know, Raw's 2 hours, and now all of a sudden we're in big arenas, and we got the Titantron, and now Brett's swearing on TV, you know, it's like,
right.
And then Brett's a heel, and Austin's blown up, and then we have a street fight, and then Brian Pillman comes back, and it's like every week was more and more and more, and that's not even kind of what's going behind, you know, behind the scenes, which was all amazing too. So
it was hard to write because of that, because I mean, it's the biggest of the three by quite a bit as well, by at least a good maybe 10,000-20,000 words, I think, and so it's like a fifth bigger than all the others. But and we had to leave so much out that, you know, just didn't fit anywhere, because the overall narrative was, or the overall narrative's really a Vince changing everything and going full bore with this new thing, Steve Austin bubbling underneath and then exploding, and then the Bret Shawn stuff. And in the background, you've got what's going on in WCW, with WCW sort of slowly, without realizing it, despite being at its peak, imploding and we describe it in the book as sort of death by a thousand paper cuts, like lots of little mistakes that were all slowly building up and building up and building up. Starting with Sold Out and what a disaster that was in 97, and then, you know, backstage disharmony between everybody and, you know, just the general disorganization going on there. And it was just everything combining for them as well, but also the rise of ECW under pay-per-view and their tie-in with the WWF. So you've got all of these little threads that all tie together, because the ECW thing is in part is what inspired the Attitude thing as well. And all of that's covered in detail. There's a lot of Justin's done a great job on the ECW stuff in there. And he's got a load of exclusive interviews and exclusive versions of stories that people have probably heard the story but never heard the truth about, like the Todd Gordon mole situation in ECW and the situation with the ECW Raw. And, you know, he interviewed like Rob Van Dam and Todd Gordon himself and Danny Doring, who was there, and a couple other guys, and really got the sort of behind the scenes tale of what it was really like, what was really going on. And it all ties in with the WWF and WCW stuff as well. But at the same time, we had to leave out so much. I mean, because for all it was interesting, it was almost irrelevant to what was the bigger picture, was behind the scenes, not really on the screen, you know? So for all you've got these great cards like Canadian Stampede, it's just a tiny snippet as far as in what happened overall in the course of the year. So it could have been twice the size. It could have been two books. It really could, which is why I dreaded it so much in advance.
So much. Such an amazing year to dissect. So working on these books, did it change your perception on anyone as you were working on and stuff you were digging up and reading through, as someone you thought, you know, was maybe like a really great guy ended up being a piece of shit, or vice versa, someone you thought maybe was a, you know, douchebag or something, then you read some stuff on him and found out, hey, you know, this guy wasn't such a bad guy after all, or just anything along those lines?
I think by now, after doing the first two books, the characters are all basically the same. It's the same players involved. Right. And so I did know a lot. I mean, about 97, I probably knew the most without research about that year. Because it was, like you say, it's such a good year. So you want to know as much as you can about it. And because so much happened. But mm-hmm. I mean, there was one. As I was writing it, I became quite good friends with Brian Pillman's daughter, Brittany, who, she was only 5 years old when her dad died in 97.
Right.
But she gave me a lot of information about what happened after that with her and with Melanie, and who was a stepmom, and the other kids, and sort of what happened, you know, sort of, you see what happens on screen and you see Melanie on the screen, but then no one hears from any of them for the next 20 years. So no one knows. And she filled me in, and it was sort of harrowing, actually. Like Melanie had spent all the money on drugs. This is according to Brittany, so we don't get sued, but you know,
right.
She according to her, like Melanie had spent all the money that Vince had given her and that the tribute shows had given them, and the DVD royalties and such, spent it all on drugs. The kids hadn't seen anything. You know, they got kicked out of the house, and she had to go and live with like her auntie, which is Brian's sister. And you know, it's just this crazy story and like really like upsetting story as well. But then I had to write about Brian and Melanie's relationship. And it was difficult because I had to write about Melanie, how Vince had portrayed her as this, you know, or how she was this grieving widow, and how Vince had done this awful thing, really, by putting the guy's widow on TV literally the next day after he died, mm-hmm. just for, as a ratings ploy, and try and make people feel sympathy for her while knowing that really she was already in the process of divorcing him. She was already carrying the child of another guy, and, you know, she'd actually got a restraining order against Brian a couple of months before that. So, you know, if he hadn't died, if he died 6 months later, they'd already be divorced. The kids have all got the money, you know, it'd have been completely different. But
right.
So that was interesting. So my perception of her changed. But as far as the wrestlers, I mean, I think I sort of knew enough about the characters and the people we were dealing with that, you know, there was no real surprises there. Maybe Bischoff, he comes across pretty well in this book. And, you know, as he maybe should as well, because he made some quite smart moves in 97. He was just a little bit over his head as far as the organizational stuff. But a lot of that actually came from above with the AOL Time Warner merge, which caused a lot of problems in WCW, and ultimately killed them. That is what killed WCW, the merge.
I was going to ask you that. They might have obviously survived. Ted Turner stayed in control with Time Warner. I mean, I think that gets overlooked so much, and everyone wants to say the finger poke and this and that. Yeah. But no, if AOL doesn't, you know, bring that corporate structure into place, and Ted Turner doesn't get forced out of the board of directors and, you know, head control of the, you know, whole company, yeah, WCW probably doesn't go away because Ted Turner's still ticking today, you know? So, I mean, and he always had the soft spot for wrestling.
If Ted Turner was still in power with WCW at that time, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. And if WCW had lost millions of dollars every single year from then up until now, but Ted Turner was the one in charge, WCW would still be here now, mm-hmm. because he was so loyal to wrestling, because he wouldn't have his empire if it wasn't for wrestling. You know, that's the truth of it. Wrestling helped build his station. I guess it was it Georgia Wrestling back in the day? You know, but it helped build his station. It helped build his empire. It helped him expand. And he was always so loyal, fiercely loyal to wrestling because of that. And it lost money every single year up until like 96, 97. And he didn't care because he wanted wrestling. And he would always have it. He would always have it on his station. He'd have made changes, sure, if it was losing $100 million a year, but he never would have got rid of it while it was feasible that it could be sustained. And the only reason it died was because of the merger, and it probably died sooner than it would have. Once Ted was out of power, and, you know, I guess it was Jamie Kellner came in, mm-hmm. and cancelled it, you know, it was, if he was going to cancel it anyway because he didn't want wrestling. It was like over here, we had a guy called Greg Dyke, who cancelled World of Sport Wrestling, which was huge over here. Really, really huge. Like, bigger than anything on Saturday afternoons. You know, it would be... We have we call it football. You guys call it soccer. But we have a thing over here called the FA Cup, which is, you know, this the biggest cup competition in English football. And it's the biggest day in English football as far... Or it used to be at the time. Biggest day in English football. And the wrestling would go opposed to it, you know, on a different channel, and beat it in the ratings, because more people would watch wrestling than football, and everybody watches football over here, you know, just like you guys all watch your football, you know, same kind of thing. And he just took it off the air because he didn't want it on the air. He felt it didn't fit the station. And Kellner was basically the same. He was like, you know what, I don't like wrestling. It's lowbrow. It's for idiots. You know, it's for, you know, mouth breathers, and it's, I don't want it. And if the ratings were good, it probably would have had a stay of execution. And if it wasn't losing money, it probably would have stayed around to a degree. But it was going to die anyway. So the finger poke of doom just hurried it rather than killed it.
Yeah, and these little things accelerated the process that was already...
Yeah, yeah, it was already doomed. Anyway. Yeah, it was already doomed.
So you mentioned World of Sport. And it's funny because that's kind of becomes, you know, I don't know, call it a brand, but I guess a promotion that's really gained steam. In some of our circles here, we have a close relationship with the Pro Wrestling Only message board, and they've been doing they completed a project, the Greatest Wrestler Ever project. So they spent 2.5-3 years doing tons of like footage viewing and research, and they had a bunch of people submit their ballots. And Jim Brakes is a guy that has gained a lot of steam because they last did this project 10 years ago. So it's been 10 years since. And it's a guy they've seen a lot of footage on and has rose up a lot of lists. Do you have any knowledge or memories? I'm only asking because I know some of our listeners will enjoy the sidebar. But were you a Brakes fan, or do you have any knowledge of
I mean, Brakes to career? Be honest, World of Sport was actually a little bit before my time because it went off TV over here. And I think it was 88. It might have been 86. And I was born in 84. So it was pretty much done and dusted by the time I was old enough to know what it was. But since then, I have obviously as well been part of the British wrestling scene over here. I have watched it back. I've met some of the guys who were involved and worked with a couple of them who are still around. And yeah, I mean, I know Jim Brakes is absolutely a very influential, a very talented guy, but there were so many very influential and very talented guys over here, you know, and it's a shame that when people think of World of Sport now, the first names that come to the head tend to be Giant Haystacks, Big Daddy.
Right.
And it's like, man, that's not what it was. You know, we had so much more talent than that. And I think now is probably the closest we've ever been in British wrestling to going back to that, you know, with Will Ospreay's win the other day in Japan. And, you know, the amount of sort of British talent in WWE at the moment and on the indies generally. I mean, like Zack Sabre Jr., for example, phenomenal talent. And I think he'll probably do fairly well in this Cruiserweight tournament coming up as well. He might even win it. I don't know. But, you know, it's so wrestling over here has made this huge comeback recently. We've got this promotion in Scotland called ICW, which is huge numbers, incredible fan base. This real, basically the closest thing I've seen to ECW since ECW, you know, including Ring of Honor or anything else. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And I think it's great that we've got that again. And I think World of Sport people now are sort of seeing these British guys and going, you know, I wonder what all the fuss about this is about then. You know, if these British guys are good, what were the old sort of British guys like? And
right.
And they're discovering that, yeah, some of the talent that we had is phenomenal. I mean, Dynamite Kid would be a prime example, you know, of the kind of talent you can get in Britain or could get in Britain.
Are you part of the Big Daddy for Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame contingent that's out there?
I didn't vote for him this year, and I won't vote for him next year.
I'm going to break a lot of hearts out there.
I'm sorry. He's just, if anything, he killed it. But that's maybe a controversial opinion for some, but it was down. I can understand why Greg Dyke wanted rid of it when he saw a Big Daddy match.
How about Sting? Did you vote for Sting? That's another big point of contention out there.
No, I didn't. I didn't vote for Sting. What's he done? Getting a push is different to deserving a place in the Hall of Fame, especially the Observer Hall of Fame. He deserves to be in WWE's because it's just a, you know, everything they own Hall of Fame. But does he deserve to be in a wrestling Hall of Fame? You tell me. He got a big push, and as you will read about in Titan Screwed, it was a big disaster because we do cover that, the Starrcade situation. There's a chapter devoted to Starrcade because that's really the start of the WCW death knell. For all it's peak, it's also really a steep, steep slope after that. And the Sting Hogan match was a lot to do with it. And Sting turned up and wasn't really interested, wasn't really in good shape, didn't have a good match. And immediately, it was amazing how someone's mystique and appeal could be shattered so quickly. And so, no, I mean, I like Sting. I enjoy watching him. Like everyone else, I'd love to see this Undertaker match. That's never going to happen. Just to see the pure theater and what they could do with it if they did it right. And I think he's had great matches with Flair and others. But at the same time, has he ever had a great match where he hasn't been against someone better than him? Be hard to pick one, really.
Yeah, no. I mean, all his great matches. I'm, you know, shuffling to my head real quick. I'm like, no. Vader's better than him. No. Regal's better than him. You know, I'm trying to think of some of those really highly touted matches. And yeah, it's.
I don't want to be like, I hate Sting. Cause I don't. I love Sting. I love that character. I love the Crow character in '97. I thought it was perfectly executed, right up until when it mattered. But it's just. That's just a push, though. Like, it's nothing. It's a push isn't the same as, you know, being Hall of Fame worthy, especially when there's so many guys who I think are probably Hall of Fame worthy who aren't in there.
Now, he's a real interesting case study for sure, because he's someone that so many people of our generation just grew up on and were told was a major star, right? I mean, his WCW presented him as a top guy. So when you hear that he's not in this Hall of Fame with almost, you know, majority of his peers, it's kind of like, well, all right, when's he getting it next? You mentioned other guys. You want to just name one or two that you feel should be in that aren't?
Come back to me and that one. I'll tell you who I voted for.
All right, we're going to do a couple of the what-ifs then, and then we'll come back to that one. So head back to 95. You have Vince's ear, right? So we're into January 95. Diesel's a champion. We're headed towards WrestleMania 11. What's like two or three things you would have done differently from what he did in that arc from 11 to 12? Just anything. It could be little. It could be big. What would you have done to maybe get in Vince's ear and said, hey, Vince, here's what we should do in between WrestleMania 11 and WrestleMania 12?
It's a loaded question.
Yeah, very loaded.
I mean, what could you do with that talent roster? Because all the pieces were in the wrong place, I think. You know, you had – why was Brett in the – and the undercard, you know, why was Undertaker in the undercard? And it was close to politics. I mean, that's obviously the real reason, but it's difficult because, I mean, you tell me, do you think WrestleMania 12 was good?
It was important.
Sure. I'd agree.
I don't know.
Was it booked right? I mean, I don't think WrestleMania 11 was booked right, but
I think 12 was booked right for what they had. Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I mean, they did have to rely on, you know, three stars from the past and Piper, Jake, and Warrior right, coming back around the same time. And
a third of the card being eaten up by one match as well.
Yeah, which was a huge error. But it's they got to where they wanted to go eventually anyway, but I don't think they really could have pulled the trigger on changing things in between that time. It wasn't the right time. Vince wanted to do it. Even then, and in conversations like with Mick Foley when he hired Mick at the end of 95, or when they had their first talks, you know, he was like, you know, we want to go in this edgy direction and you'd be good for that. But it was never the right time. There was always something happening to sort of prevent it. And at the time, throughout 95 as well, they were so strict on the drug policy. For all those guys on pills who could get away with it because of who they were, they definitely couldn't take steroids. And that was difficult for Vince because he didn't have that like one guy who was big and imposing and like Hulk Hogan, because that's what he thought a babyface was, that he could get behind it and really push. So he was just like plucking at straws. And as far as what would you do otherwise? I mean, who knows? They tried everything anyway. They tried Mabel. I mean, anyone could have told you Mabel wasn't the right answer, but
I knew,
you know,
that at age 14, and that is
Oh yeah, Jesus! But should they have pulled the trigger on Shawn earlier? Yeah, probably. I think it was obvious by WrestleMania that Diesel wasn't drawing as they hoped. You know, I think it's in the book that the joke it what used to be with the agents. I wonder how long the WWF will be running on Diesel power for, because.
Right.
You know, the houses are the worst they've ever been. And I think someone said something like that to him, and he was like, yeah, well, you're the lowest drawn champion there's ever been. I think it was Briscoe. And he had no answer to that, because he was. And for all he wasn't responsible for the bad WrestleMania buy rate, it was he was also deemed not worthy of being in the main event, and that him and Shawn wouldn't sell out or get a good buy rate. So they had to bring something else in. So, and if that's what you have to do with your champion, then your champion's probably wrong. So what could they have done? I mean, they could have put the belt on Shawn there. They could, because by the time they did it, there was a bit of resentment towards him because his character had become this happy, slappy baby face. But in 95, he still had a bit of an edge. So maybe they could have gone in that direction and Shawn could have been this edgy, not quite heel, but not quite babyface tweener character. And it might have worked. It might work better in the long run for him, for his sanity. I don't know. But it's ifs and buts. It could be anything. Ultimately, it worked out well for him. If you'd have changed something then, the butterfly effect would have affected everything down the line. And, you know, Austin 316 probably wouldn't have happened. And, you know, The Rock wouldn't have come along or whatever it might have been. So I think ultimately things worked out quite well for them. It just took them a long time to get there. I mean, what would you have done?
Yeah, I don't know if I would have stuck with Diesel as long. One guy, and this is one of my other questions, so we could tie them together. Was there anyone that was a big, you know, missed opportunity to you in between 95 and 97? And one guy I always think of, you know, is like a Bam Bam Bigelow. And I know he got screwed by the political nature of his issues with the Click and all that. But to me, he's a guy that had the potential, had the look, had the pedigree, had been there a little bit. And I thought the rush to turn him face after 11 was a, you know, misstep for them. I would have kept him heel a little bit longer and had him be Diesel's first real one-on-one solo opponent heading into like King of the Ring or something. And then you do the turn more organically instead of just turning him haphazardly. And I don't think that saves things, but I think it gives Diesel a guy he can work with that's, you know, bigger than him, has believable offense, and is better than like a Mabel. And then you could push Sid back a little bit. I would have made Sid more of a, you know, a vicious heel instead of being more of a, you know, they kind of made him like a pussy heel, and I would have avoided that. I would have made him more like he was in like 92 versus what they had him be. And I think if you do that and you stretch that out into, you know, SummerSlam, and I probably would have found a better way to use Luger. I know the stink was on him of being a choker, but at the end of the day, still a name. He was still getting reactions.
Yeah, he was better than just a random tag team with Davey Boy. Davey Boy as well. Same applies, really.
I would have maybe gotten behind Owen more, too. Like, they had a lot of talent. They just had it, like you said, all shuffled in weird spots on the roster. I would have had Sean just win King of the Ring. Everyone wanted to see it. I think you save your Philly fan base on that show if you have Sean just win the tournament. I mean, they were dying for him on that night.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And then maybe you run Sean Diesel again, you know, because he's King of the Ring, and then you have Sean beat him at SummerSlam in the Mania rematch. So, I don't know. This is a quick path to win.
It would have been – it definitely would have been better than what they had, you know, which was, you know – awful Diesel Sid matches, random tag matches in the main event, and Mabel. So yeah, of course that would have been better. Like you said, they did have the talent. They really could have done a lot with the guys they brought in as well. I mean, Austin came in at the end of that year. Mm-hmm. Mick came in pretty soon after that, and you know they did have the pieces, and they just weren't in the right place. And you know when you look at the Attitude Era, a lot of those guys who got over and were successful were the same guys who, maybe not 95, but in 96, were really floundering on the card. And they all got the right gimmick, they got the right push, and they got over, you know. But it was the same guys who had been struggling at the company's lowest point, really, because the reigns in 1996, for example, were absolutely atrocious.
Oh, yeah, brutal.
And the buy rates as well. Like nobody cared in 1996. But if you look at the Survivor Series 96 card, for example, on the free for all,
right?
You've got Road Dogg, Just Incredible, Hardcore Holly, Bart Gunn, Rikishi, JBL, Billy Gunn, all of whom became, well, maybe not Just Incredible, but he became ECW champion. But they all became big stars or did something big in the Attitude Era and beyond. And then there was Sal Sincere, but we'll just forget about him. But, you know, the others. And yet at Survivor Series 96, they were all in the opening match and not even on the pay-per-view. And they all became big players, but they were all around. Everyone was all there. Mm-hmm. And it was only when, and I hate to give him credit, but it was only when they did go with what Vince Russo was saying, and like make people a little bit more realistic, and obviously he took it too far eventually, but make them more realistic, make them more like real people, give them this bit of attitude, get rid of this mom and pop cartoon bullshit that we've been feeding them for the last decade. And, you know, understand that the fans that you had then have grown up and they are now the fans you've got now. They're not new fans. They're just the same fans. They're just older, and market what we're doing to them, grow with the fan base, and which eventually obviously they did, and it worked pretty well for them. But yeah, they had the talent. It was just Vince and his genius hadn't quite figured out how to use him yet.
And I think, I mean, Russo gets dumped on a ton, and deservedly so. But he was a major, major cog in that turnaround there. Because I don't, you know, without him gaining power and getting in Vince's ear, I know Shane played a role too, but I don't know if he ever goes over the edge without Russo really, really nudging him and pushing him. I mean, he definitely deserves.
And you know, we mentioned that in the new book. You know, we talk about Russo's involvement and how that was pretty much the final straw almost as far as Vince was concerned when it was there was a Raw show in Berlin, which was just horribly lit, horribly produced. It was just lots of wrestling, cold wrestling. There was that great Davey Boy Owen match, but yes, that didn't make up for the rest of it, which was just, it was just matches that meant nothing. And when
and
the
South
rating
Africa
came,
one too, right, was a real
horrific. It was awful. And you know, when the ratings came in and it was like under a 2 for the first time, and Vince just lost his mind. I was like, you know what, that's it. You know, we'll listen to this guy. We're not doing that anymore. But everyone had already been telling him, don't do this show, it's a bad idea. So, and he just did. So, and then, you know, he went with Russo, and you only have to look at sort of WrestleMania 13 to see the brutality on display. Mm-hmm. And also the juxtaposition of ideas, because you've got Austin and Bret and this brutal, bloody match. And, you know, you've got the Chicago Street Fight with Ahmed Johnson getting hanged and things like that. And but then in the same card, you've got the Sultan and Rocky Maivia, and it's like, what's this? You know, and it's this strange sort of the worlds colliding situation. And eventually they ironed out the creases. And after Brian died and Vince was going to put Melanie on Raw, and at the start of Raw, he got everyone together and said, look, you know, we've been moving in this direction for some time, but from now on, this is what we're doing. This is the new direction. This is the new attitude. This is how it's going to be here. And, you know, this is what we feel we need to do and move the business forward, which was his way of justifying to the boys what he was going to do with Melanie that night, because a lot of them weren't particularly happy with that.
Right.
And, you know, it was his way of saying, well, we're Shock TV now, and that's how it's going to be. And then if you look at sort of, look at King of the Ring 97 and just like the way it's presented and the sort of type of matches you've got on there. And then look at King of the Ring 98, mm-hmm. only a year later, and what a striking difference it is.
I was at King of the Ring 97 too, trust me. It was not, right, not easy
then,
to sit
then,
through.
Then you know. So, but it's so different. Like, you go from this cartoon product to this ridiculous Attitude Era spectacle with the Hell in a Cell and everything, and you know, Austin and Kane, and if he loses, he's going to be set on fire, or he's going to bleed. And, you know, you've got all this... Yeah, it's a great angle. And you've got UFC guys coming in. And, you know, it's fascinating really how quickly they can change things and change direction where they want to do it. And it just took them time to get there, you know.
That's always one of my favorite Vince lines. He'll breathe his last breath, you know. Like, all right, that's a little intense.
Yeah, but you know,
if he loses, he's going to die. Sorry, guys.
Basically, but people believed it, though. Oh, yeah. That's the thing. And so it doesn't matter how outlandish it is if people buy it.
Only Vince could have gotten that over. One of my favorite stories in the 96 book, and definitely something I never knew and put together, because to me it was always real disappointing, the run, and that's Vader. Like, I didn't know any of that injury stuff and how he worked through it and came back. Or, like, that stuff to me was some of the best stuff in that book, because I literally knew nothing about that. I always wondered why they fucked with him so bad, and that put it all into perspective.
And his name as well.
Right. Yes.
Name,
yes.
You know, refusing to be the Mastodon, and
yep.
and he regrets to this day. You know, he realizes that if he'd just gone with what Vince wanted, he'd have probably gotten a push like Mick did when he agreed to go with Mankind. I mean, it could have gone the other way. It could have gone the way of Dean Douglas and such. But you know, it's hard to know. But if Vince is fully behind you, and then he's going to market you, and when he's marketing you, he's invested in you because you're going to make him money.
Right.
And that's
they
what
could
all
always
this is
turn
about.
To Vader anyway. Look at the Ringmaster, you know? It's like.
Yeah, I mean, look at Farouk as well. I mean, everyone knew him as Ron Simmons, but he got over as Farouk and it worked anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and everyone just knew him as the sort of both, really, by the end. But same with Mick. I mean, he just became Mick Foley by the end. And that was fine. You know, people evolve. People need to evolve in wrestling. If Hulk Hogan had gone, you know, I don't want to be, what was it, Sterling Golden anymore?
Right, right, yeah.
No, I want to be Sterling Golden. That Hulk Hogan thing sounds stupid. You know, if he was smart enough to realize, and Vader just wasn't smart enough to realize, because understandably, he'd built up a reputation as Vader. He'd built up this character, but Vince is never going to get behind a creation from somewhere else.
Especially after you turn him down, another option.
Yeah, I mean, and when has he ever got behind a creation from somewhere else? Really, you know, over the years, it's always something he's either made himself or takes credit for.
Right, like, or both. Slightly modified, like Flair, you know, like where he...
Even Flair, though, I mean, he only used him for a year before he decided he couldn't be doing with him
but
anymore.
But he still gave his belt, which is, you know, was big at the time to bring it
only
down
to keep it warm, though.
Right, yeah, true.
You know, because who else could they have put it on at that show?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Hogan.
Hogan was done, though. That was right. The point. So, yeah. You know, they knew Hogan at that point. They needed to get rid of him because he was a lightning rod. So
it, I guess.
It was a difficult situation from that, to be honest. And Flair was the only logical choice. And I don't know. I can't think of many examples where someone's come in and been better in the WWF or WWE than they were when they were a name elsewhere.
Right.
Goldberg, DDP, Sting, Raven.
Even RVD. I mean, it took them 6 years to get behind them, or five years to actually push them. Even a Chris Jericho. Like, now they treat him like he's unbeatable, you know, gold, but that's only after they broke him down completely and rebuilt him.
And he was still and always will be better when he was in WCW. He's just that character. He's never topped it.
Oh, wait, it was close. When he's doing, like, the Bockwinkel.
That was close. I'll give you that. That was close. But he wasn't... I mean, he was entertaining in a different way, right. I think, then. It was completely, completely different. He's all certainly not as entertaining now.
So. He's had quite the up and down year. So a couple quick hit questions, and we'll talk the book, and then we'll wrap up. Before we get back to the Hall of Fame thing, what was the... Because you obviously watched a lot of matches, too, for this, right? Because I know there were some match breakdowns in there. There's some sections where you'd, you know, really just go, you know, deep dive into the match. What was your favorite match to watch while writing these books? Was there one that you watched and were like, man, this match still does it for me, or wow, I didn't realize how good this match was?
From the whole series?
Yeah.
I think the Bret Hart Jean-Pierre Lafitte match really surprised me. Because, I mean, I watched it at the time, but I haven't watched it since. And at the time, I can't remember how old I was, but 11, I guess, 10 or 11. And I was like, you know, I don't really like Jean-Pierre Lafitte. I don't like the stupid pirate. Why is he wrestling Bret Hart, my favorite, you know? But now when you watch it back, I appreciate what a great worker Jean-Pierre Lafitte was and how underappreciated he is. You know, he for a guy his size, he flew around the ring and he did some really cool stuff, cool moves, you know, to watch, like visually impressive moves. And his psychology as well, being there with Bret helps, but his psychology and pacing was pretty good as well. And that match is really, really good because they both go out there with a point to prove. They're like, Bret wants to prove he should be the guy and not Diesel and not Sean and not anybody. And Lafitte wants to prove himself after his little situation with Kevin Nash. And they end up having this really barnstorming match. And it was really fun to watch that one back and go over it. Conversely, watching back like Undertaker and King Kong Bundy was like sheer hell.
That is a rough match.
I mean, I think I probably overdid it in the first one as far as the match descriptions and such. It maybe wasn't as necessary. So I was sort of aiming it towards almost like an audience that doesn't know wrestling to a degree, like, or trying to make it accessible to an audience that doesn't understand wrestling. So they could understand like the workings of a match. And again, being a former worker, that made those sections a little bit easier to do. And I thought maybe that'd be interesting, but I think it was too much. And then 96, we sort of dialed it down a little bit and it was just like the important parts or relevant parts. Like the we mainly went for the Bret Austin and the Sid Sean match from Survivor Series because of the juxtaposition and the crowd differences and mainly cost of the crowd, actually, with it being the Garden and with Austin getting this huge hero reaction and Bret getting a hero reaction as well, while simultaneously Vince and JR are burying him on commentary subtly. And then Sean's reaction in that match, you know, which changed everything, really. And so they needed describing and explaining and like getting into the mindset of the guys in the matches so you can understand where they're coming from and sort of how they're feeling at the time and things like that. But I think, and Sid, Sean, I mean, that's a really underrated match, I think. It's really Sid's best match by a mile. You know?
Yeah, there's except for that one random one. Didn't you have a good one with Goldberg out of nowhere, like 99 or something?
Yeah, but I mean, I think we've all tried to repress that era from our memories.
Very true. All right, so before we wrap, tell me, who are the couple guys you want in that Hall of Fame?
Okay, I had Daniel Bryan, because for all he's achieved, most of the things he's achieved away from the mainstream, I think as far as an actual wrestler, there's few in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years who can come close to him. His WWE run, I think, is probably the worst run of his career from an in-ring perspective, even though he had some great matches, but I don't think he can top some of the Ring of Honor stuff he did. Kurt Hennig, I think, should be in the Hall of Fame, again, based on his ability and based on the fact that he was such an influential guy behind the scenes with so many of the boys that maybe people don't realize. And, you know, I think it's hard to find anyone who took a better bump than he did outside of maybe Shawn Michaels. Mm-hmm. And how many guys he made look great. And I think if he'd been given a push, like Sting, then he'd be, you know, people would put him in immediately. But it's because he never got that real main event level push. I mean, I know he did in AWA, but I've talked about promotions that were successful so, at the time, you know, because when Kurt was champion there, it wasn't
right.
Best.
Down
know?
Days, yep.
Yeah, and so I think he should be there. I think Lesnar for his, you know, he's had brief careers in wrestling and MMA,
mm-hmm.
really, when you sort of look at it, but how many people have had careers that short but that effective? You know, he's
yes.
The numbers that he draws, the quality of the matches that he puts on consistently, and everyone knows he's a phenomenal athlete and a phenomenal talent, and I think he's good enough given some of the guys that are in there. This one might be more controversial, but I think Ultimate Warrior should be in it. And the reason being, look, if you ask random non-wrestling fan on the street, who name me five wrestlers, chances are one will be Hulk Hogan, one will be Steve Austin, one will be The Rock, and the others are probably going to be one of like Randy Savage, Ultimate Warrior, or, I don't know, Goldberg, but not Goldberg, someone else.
Well, yeah, a couple, like Million Dollar Man to me is one, or Jake the Snake. Like,
right,
those
yeah.
are two you probably would hear.
Gimmicks from the classic
yeah, Roddy 80s
Piper. Era, Piper, yeah. yeah. And gimmicks that they know, like, because that names that they've heard and remember, they're not going to say Batista, they're not going right, to say, right. probably not going to say John Cena either, to be honest. They won't, certainly won't say Daniel Bryan, but they would know who Ultimate Warrior was. If you
Brockus,
watch.
You think maybe they say Brockus?
I mean, if you watch, for example, I watch How I Met Your Mother,
yep.
or I used to when it was on, and I think there was an episode where they were all dressed up to go to wrestling, and they were dressed up, one of them was dressed up as Ultimate Warrior, and then there was another show, I think it was that, what would it be? Scrubs it was, mm-hmm. I think, when they used to be on, and they did this wrestling, you know, little cut to this wrestling fantasy or whatever it was, and he was dressed as Ultimate Warrior. And it's like, it's iconic. He's an iconic guy. For all he wasn't the best in the ring, but I think he's underrated, but I think he was such an influence on the industry, even if people don't want to admit it. And, you know, he actually did have more good matches than people realize. I actually wrote a book before I started doing the Titan series, when I was writing like review books, we do things like cover every episode of Raw and like analyze them in detail. Like,
yes, I did start reading one of those. Yep. The Coliseum video one, I think.
Coliseum videos as well. Yeah, they're a little bit different. I mean, they're more sort of collector's guides for fans, you know. And
right.
I call them toilet books. Like,
yeah.
book you'd read in the toilet.
yep. Or on the treadmill.
Or on the treadmill. And, we did an Ultimate Warrior one. We're like, let's do the entire career of a wrestler, of his every sort of match that we can access that was ever shown on TV. So we covered literally every Ultimate Warrior match that's ever been televised in the last, you know, in his career.
Right, that's awesome.
And some of them, it wasn't all awesome, but
in theory,
some of it really was. You know, that match with Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7 is mm-hmm. close to perfect.
Ranked wrestling. Second. We ranked back in April. We ranked every every WrestleMania match. It was a huge project we did on the site, and that came in second behind Austin and Brett.
Austin Brett, right? As it should as well. I mean, I work for WhatCulture.com.
Yes. Yep.
Now, and we just one of the first things I did when I started working there was help them implement a new magazine, which actually came out last month, of which I'm the editor and a contributor of quite a chunk of it. And so if you like any of the Titans, buy that magazine. But its key feature is a top 100 list. Mm-hmm. And it's the top 100 WWE matches of all time, as voted on by wrestlers and fans and the writers and such. And I mean, that Warrior Savage match ranked pretty damn high. And so did Warrior Hogan. And I find that quite interesting, because I thought the more modern fans maybe wouldn't appreciate those two matches because they're not the kind of what you'd consider a great wrestling match by today's standards, but they are a great story. There's great storytelling. It's not about spots. It's about the drama. And whereas I think nowadays it's about, let's do 20 finishes. What a great match that was. And it was just sort of, it was perfect storytelling, especially Savage Warrior. And, yeah, I think it's probably one of my favorite matches of all time. You know,
and Savage is a guy too that everyone was so familiar with his story, and he always had such emotional angles that made his matches so good. And that was another one. I mean, that Savage Elizabeth story had been going on since 1985. You know, and it's like it finally pays off six years later on top of an awesome match. You know?
Yeah, and then the fact that he's retiring as well, and you've got this turn at the end, and you know this match that's been billed as bigger than the title, and this, you know, he's kicked out, he's hit him with everything he's got, and Warrior still kicks out, but Warrior earlier had doubted himself and almost given up, and it's like, man, there's so much there, and I hope that one lasts the test of time. And I think almost for that match alone, and I am biased because of how much I loved it as a kid, you know, and how much I still love it to this day, but almost for that match alone, I think he deserves to go in. But I think he was very, very influential on the business, and I think people will remember him as one of the icons of wrestling down in years to come. And WWE obviously now do. So mm-hmm. that's his story now. He's going to be around forever as long as they're around, as their, you know, Andre the Giant type heralded lionized figure.
Yeah.
Now, especially now they've got a statue of him, you know. They cost a lot of money, those things.
Yes, not cheap at all. This hour and a half has flown by, James.
Yeah, man, I can't believe it's been so long.
We'll do this again for sure. But before we go, I want to give you a moment. I'm going to sit back. I want you to plug anything and everything you want to plug. The books, the site, what you got upcoming, anywhere we can find you. Go ahead, have at it.
I hate plugging myself in such a manner. I hate it. But if you're interested in anything you just heard, then go and check out any of the Titan books. Titan Sinking, Titan Shattered, and the new one, Titan Screwed. All available on any Amazon, wherever you are, in the UK, in America, in Japan, even, if you've got Japanese listeners. You can get it on there. Just, you know, type it in. You'll find them all. You can also buy the physical version of the book, the paperback, from lulu.com. Again, just type it in the search. And you can buy it from shop.whatculture.com, where you can also buy the first issue of What Culture Wrestling magazine, which we just discussed with the top 100s and a bunch of features and a couple of articles, actually, like I told you about Brittany Pillman earlier, there's actually a feature about that situation in there, which is, it picked up a lot of steam when I first wrote the story a couple of months back. So, you know, it's quite interesting. Other than that, I can occasionally be found doing video podcasts at War Culture. Join the hateful commenters on YouTube who don't like facts. And truth.
They don't like anything.
And no, they don't like anything. So come and defend me if you agree with me and you're over the age of 12. Or if you're under the age of 12, come and bury me as much as you want. I find it excellent fun. But that's about it. If you enjoy the book, please, by all means, get in touch with me. You know, my email is jamesdixonwriter@gmail.com. I'm quite happy to hear from you. Don't spam me, or I'll send you viruses, but I won't really. But by all means, if you enjoyed the books or want to know more, then yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
And if you are going to order on Amazon, go to PlaceMeNation.com. On the right-hand side, there's an Amazon banner. Then you go buy the books, all of them. And then we all benefit. So make sure you do that as well.
100%. I would strongly advise that as the way forward for everybody.
Beautiful. James, we're going to have you back on again to deep dive on this stuff. We have about 75 podcasts on this website. So you could definitely probably fit into about 73 of them besides the American sports ones maybe. But definitely want to have you back. We love your books. Love all the work you're doing at What Culture. Thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to talking to you soon. Everyone be sure to go out, buy the books, and James, we'll have you back soon.
Thank you, man. I'll come back anytime you want me.
Awesome. All right, there you have it. It was awesome having James Dixon on. Be sure you order his books. Get on that now. Click on our Amazon link. Go over there, buy them all. Great reads. A lot of fun. Great guests. We'll definitely have him back on. Wanted to give a big thanks to our friend Jeff Jarvis over at PlayStation.com. Helps us with our Vintage Vault refresh reviews on the site and the ebooks. Also played a big role in getting James on the show here with us tonight. So thank you, Jeff. Also, be sure to check out PlayStation.com each and every day. Tons of podcasts, tons of written articles. And if you haven't come in a couple of weeks, or you're on vacation, or you didn't have your internet or anything like that, and you're wondering what you missed, click the index at the top. It has every single piece we've ever published in order by month. So be sure to check that out. It has everything you could ever want. Like I said, click that Amazon link. Also, make sure you check out our free ebooks. The link is there on the right-hand side as well. Find us on Facebook.com/PlayStation, on Twitter, on Tumblr, on everything else social media related, Instagram as well. If you have any questions, you can hit us up on all those methods. But for myself, I want to thank Steve Willey for coming on earlier as well. I want to thank James Dixon for joining us for that chat. And we'll thank Scott anyway, even though he's not here tonight. First time in 409 episodes, I went bell to bell without my PIC. Felt a little weird, but he'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Actually, next week, I should say, a week from today. We'll be talking Vengeance 2006 for our Vintage Vault review on that. So until then, everyone take care. Be sure to check out all the other shows here at PlayStation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world. I'll just banter with myself, I guess. How you doing? I'll see you later. That was fun. Games are awesome.